Hi everybody, hope you're well. My name is Jim Carroll. Welcome you to the weekly podcast from the Banter team. We'd also like to say hello to the many new listeners who've joined us over the last few weeks. We hope you enjoy what you hear. This is one of two very special Banter podcasts to bring a great busy year to an end. Recorded at Other Voices earlier this month in Dingle, County Kerry, we were joined by Nadine O'Regan from the Sunday Business Post and TXFM to run the rule over the year in the arts. From Adele and Anne Enright to Waking the Feminists and What's in Store in 2016, it's all here. Welcome along here to Banter at Foxy John's, day two. We've already had kind of sample answer providing some musical starts today. Perfect music actually to start a Sunday, I was thinking, compared to last year. Last year we had Rosangano family here hanging from the rafters, so that was kind of a very energetic start today. But I'll always remember afterwards interviewing Noreen Hegarty, the former editor of Sunday Tribune, now with Lonely Planet up here on the stage, and it smelt like a teenage boy's bedroom. The sweat up here was incredible. So at least for this one, there's no smell, right?
There's going to be a smell in about like this is like crazy. This is hot. This is a hot room.
Thanks, I'm hot. Yeah, that's great. So, would you please welcome from the Sunday Business Post and from TXFM, Nadine O'Regan. This is basically the Banter Arts Review of the Year. We'll be doing a Banter Review of the Year in the MVP in Dublin on Wednesday with Cathy Sheridan, Gráinne Healy, Zoe Cummins and Anna Walsh. But this is the Banter Arts Review of the Year. We're going to start with music because when I invited Nadine to kind of like come here, I kind of said we'd talk about X, Y and Z. And I said we'd go from A to Z and A being Adele. So I made you go off and listen to the Adele album.
Yeah, and I don't like being a pop snob. I actually love pop music, I'd like to say first of all. I like music that's made with the intention of not being particularly cool and that it's still hummable. Your postman might hum it. I have nothing against that. Yeah, I come from an indie rock background, but I'm just going to preface everything
Adele. That's a long book.
By saying that I do love pop music. But yeah, you did make me go off and listen to the Adele album, and I do hold you kind of, you know, responsible for ruining part of my week.
The reason why I suppose I mentioned the Adele one is that in all the end of year album reviews, I know the Adele album is not going to feature because it released so late.
Well, it is going to feature. It featured today in the Sunday Times Albums of the Year list, and it was interesting what they said about it because they said it's an album that's very up and down, but when it hits undeniably. And I think there's a certain fairness to that, but what really bothered me about the Adele album was that when you listen to it, and there's something like Annie DeFranco said years ago, which is, you know, the making of an album is supposed to be the recording of an event of music that the artist is having, that it's a creative experience. And I think the real issue that I have with the Adele album is not that, there's a couple of very hummable, very catchy songs on it, but for the making of that album, it was clearly a huge moment in music. There's a lot of money to be made out of it, and a lot of songwriters were brought in to potentially write songs for that Adele album. So there was a really interesting article, interview with Sia Furler in Rolling Stone recently, where she talked about how she was drafted in to write for the Adele album, and she wrote what she thought were a couple of cracking tunes, and then it didn't work. Damon Albarn of Blur has famously gone on the record saying he was also brought in to work with Adele and write some songs, and he found what she was producing to be quite middlebrow and a kind of middle of the road.
It's really funny with that Damon Albarn comment. That came from a conversation he had with a friend in a pub, but someone overheard it and took the bits they wanted out of it.
Oh, really? Yeah. Well, I mean, but the thing is, the album sounds like that. It doesn't sound like the sort of creative work of somebody that's been slogging away and produced their vision. It sounds like, and I know I'm going to sound like a pop snob for saying this, it sounds like an album made for people who don't ordinarily listen to albums. It sounds like the album that the person that doesn't buy music goes out to buy at Christmas, and then that's their album. And in ways, there's nothing wrong with that, because she's produced a couple of very good songs on it. But it bothers me as a music fan, because it gets further away from what every artist that's in Other Voices. I mean, I've been here since Friday. I'm having my little pick-me-up at Guinness. And I've been having an amazing time, and I've gone to see some incredible bands. Like, you go out and you see Bitch Falcon, or you go see Sleep Thieves, or you see, I still can't pronounce their name, Hair Squid or Squad, whatever the hell
they're
called.
You're not the only one in that regard. Have you found out yesterday?
And you think to yourself, right, there's a really amazing scene, but those bands aren't getting played on the radio. Girl bands who aren't here, but whose album is being listed in so many, you know, end of the year, they've just made it into Time magazine's top top albums of the year, and they can't get played on Irish radio. What we're doing is we're rotating. I mean, this is the year 2015. If you want to talk about 2015, it's the year that pop ruled and dominated to the exclusion of indie rock, or and that. To be honest, radio stations are pushing them out as well, because if bands don't get airplay, they might as well not exist.
Mm. But think about, like, I mean, what you described there, like, Nadine, in terms of the Adele album, you know, like, it's a great book by John Seabrook at the moment called The Song Machine, Inside the Hit Factories, and he talks about, like, I mean, all those Nordic songwriters, the people like Max Martin, the Shellback, yeah. All these producers, and the fact they have that kind of factory system. And, like, I mean, yeah, you're right. I mean, when Jonathan Dickens, Adele's manager, sat down with him and sat down with her and sat down with Richard Russell to discuss what was going on, they wanted the best possible. They were going for the expert. The leading people in their field, because that's where it's going to go. But obviously, like, the radio thing is fascinating, because I kind of find that, like, I mean, what radio plays is it's really lowest common denominator stuff. It's not my kind of music. Like, no one's playing the kind of music I want to hear on radio. Yeah. They're playing it on Spotify.
But do you ever think about, like, what radio is often called broadcasting? But what we're actually doing now is narrowcasting. You know, narrowcasting is when you take four or five songs and you put them on heavy rotation endlessly, with the aim of making sure that when that person tunes in for 10 to 15 minutes, which is what a lot of people do on their commute or whatever, they get the Snow Patrol song or they get the Taylor Swift song or whatever. But it's what I've been really excited to see even this weekend is, like, seeing, because I was talking to somebody who works in radio the other day, and we were saying, wouldn't it be amazing if, like, we were standing here talking about our respective shows and, like, say Blur and Oasis were number one and number two in the charts, fighting it out with Country House and Roll With It. You know, imagine if indie rock was that prominent in the charts. Like, imagine if we were on air at that time. Because what you've seen over the last few decades is people that specialise in indie music, world music, any kind of thing that's a little bit more subversive, a little bit more just other. It's not just the artists who've been relegated to the sidelines, it's the presenters, the DJs, the people that we once... I hesitate to name names, because that sounds like I may be cataloguing somebody's failure, you know? But there are some really great indie rock presenters out there who used to be very prominent on our schedules, and they're not anymore. If you want to hear them, you have to hear them at 2 a.m. or, you know.
Yeah, exactly. But is that not down to kind of, like, me as well, how the music trends and spectrum has changed, you know? I mean, you talked there about, like, I mean, the pop side of things, but I look at kind of, like, I mean, the influence of, like, those pop producers on, say, hip-hop and R&B, and vice versa, the influence of those hip-hop and R&B producers on pop, and, you know, and I find that very, very exciting. I mean, the indie rock thing is, like, I mean, do you kind of think, you know, that a lot of the bands who are around this moment as indie rock bands, it's quite dull.
It is dull, and I think, but what's really interesting is success allows you, money allows you creative freedom, and in some ways pop has had the freedom to be more experimental because pop is successful in the charts at the moment. So if Taylor Swift wants to go off and Kendrick Lamar, whoever, on a remix, or she can do it because her word, you know, at the moment, record company is not going to say no to her. So she has that freedom. Whereas what you find with indie rock is they're just ploughing an increasingly sort of narrow furrow,
yeah.
And it's hard to watch. I mean, there's some great experimentalism happening at the moment in pop. And what I find really interesting is that definitely the intersection where you have bands like Foals, who do something that is kind of crossover. You know, it's got that bit of electro in it, but there's enough pop, like a song like My Number or whatever, like that's, yeah, that can be bouncy enough to get into the charts, but it'll still crisscross into kind of a Whelan's nightclub. But yeah, I mean, it's been an interesting year for music, definitely.
Okay, so what albums then would be on your kind of like top five or top ten this year?
Well, I suppose I've been very, even though I didn't think that like, I love going to see girl band live. I think the album experience is a tougher one because it's a tough listen in some ways.
It's the best album for running I've come across this year.
Yeah, and actually Run the Jewels, like, I know it came out late 2014, but kind of emerged here 2015, but Close Your Eyes is the best running song ever. But girl band, definitely one I'd go back to. And then, just sticking with pop for a moment, in terms of sort of unexpected successes, and I say this, like, you know, just we're on the same line of thought. I'm not lining it up as one of my albums of the year. But in terms of people who've come around and really surprised me, the Justin Bieber album is actually really good. And I put it on to review it, and I was like, Jesus Christ, this guy, I mean, he's working with Diplo and Skrillex, and some of the tracks on that album are so hummable, so catchy, and they're kind of undeniable. You know, I was I'm friends with a young hip-hop artist on Facebook, and he just put up a little Facebook update, and he's just like, I'm so embarrassed with this, but every time it comes on the dance floor in a nightclub, doesn't matter where I am, he's running straight to the dance floor. And I think that you have to use your ears and not your kind of snobbery factor. Yeah. You can't say, right, like, if Sorry is a great song, it's a great song. Yeah. Do you know what I mean?
Totally. But that's another example then of kind of like, you know, someone like him, he's people, he's still managed by like Scooter Braun kind of saying, okay, I'm going to bring in some people. I'll bring in Diplo and Skrillex. I mightn't go for the Max Martins or the Shellbacks, but I'll bring in someone like that. It just strikes me that, like, I mean, those kind of pop stars now, it's almost like you go into a restaurant, you go into kind of Chapter One, or you go into Edith's down the road, and you order from the menu what you want. I want a bit of this, I want a bit of that.
Well, it's true. Yeah. I mean, the album that I listened to most this year and that I would come back to as like a favourite album was the Hot Chip album, because I thought it did a lot of things very, very well, and I thought they were amazing at, I didn't see them at the Metropolis, but I saw them at, was it Electric Picnic or Longitude? It was Electric Picnic. But like, they were just, for me, they were fantastic. The Fold album had some good stuff in it, but wasn't the best album. And then, was War on Drugs last year?
I think that was last year.
But there were some very good, I think most people, like, I put together Spotify playlists, and often I'm going to cherry pick. Like, I took some of the Grimes album, which was a little bit too sort of saccharine for me at points, where, you know, she was just going full on Alvin, Simon and Theodore with the kind of vocal, you know, you're like, what is happening? But there's some amazing stuff in it. So, like most people, I've been putting together Spotify or Apple Music playlists and just really going cherry picking and then listening really intently to some stuff.
Yeah, this question is going to come up in every single category. That it just seems to be that we're living in a kind of an age of excess. That there's so much music out there, you know. Yeah. You know, you rely on Spotify playlists. I found myself this year listening more and more to Spotify's Discover Weekly playlist because I couldn't believe, I was actually flabbergasted that this algorithm kind of knew what bands to throw up that I'd actually like and new tracks I'd like. Yeah. And like, it struck me that, like, me, because basically it was able to filter the new stuff for me. I was going back to it again and again. It was a way of getting through the excess. And the same applies in terms of films. I thought it was really interesting in terms of films this year. Like, I was looking at Donald Clark and Tara Brady's list on Friday, you know, and I haven't been to see any of those films.
I looked at their list as well. I was like, jeez.
But I have my own, I drew up my own top 10. I was kind of going like, okay, well, there's no other top 10 that's going to have kind of like Slow West, Me and Earl and the Dying Girl, Sicario on it. Mm. That we live in this stage of excess that suddenly our own filters are what kind of matters more.
Yeah,
more.
Well, they say as well, there was a survey that said increasingly external sources, you know, media in any format, has become less important to people than their Facebook account. You know, what friends, their actual friends are saying, go and see. So every one of your friends is now your cultural critic and is now your person, your go-to person. Somebody just throws something up, I'm going to the cinema tonight, what should I see? They're not looking necessarily at, you know, they're not running to find the last copy of their Sunday newspaper or to check out the reviews. We're absolutely fucked.
Let's move swiftly along.
I'm going to make friends with all of you guys.
let's move on. I mean, my albums of the year were Kamasi Washington, The Epic, Kendrick Lamar's Pimp a Butterfly, Girl Band, Hold Hands with
Lamar,
Jamie,
amazing,
and Romari Projections. Let's move on to books, though. Well, I mean, what kind of, like, because, I mean, you are, you read a lot.
I do read a lot. Editor, there
so
was some really great, well, Kevin Barry, as an Irish author, delivered a really interesting book with Beetlebone, which was his kind of fictionalised account of John Lennon heading back to Ireland in the 1970s, struggling with fame and deciding to go and hike out at an island that he had bought, and that was just a really kind of surreal, the level of sentence writing, I don't mean to get all kind of nerdy about it, but you could just sit there with that book and I want to go back and reread it, because he writes the freshest, most beautiful, incredible sentences, and I'm not somebody who often gets, you know, waxes lyrical about just like a couple of lines on a page, but you could sit there with that book and get so much from it, even if, as from a writing perspective, if you write, go and read him, because he makes everything fresh, he makes everything new, and the plot is actually quite slight, but the book itself is just worth it for that. But the book that had me, I'm actually kind of embarrassed to say it, because I put it up on my Instagram account afterwards, because I finished reading it at 3 a.m. one morning. And I was just gutted. I was wailing, and like it was mortifying. You'd swear like I had actually lost like a person, like an actual living person. But there's a book called A Little Life by Hanya Yanagihara, and she has written this 700-word book, or 700-page book rather, and it is an account of friends living in New York, and they're all relatively affluent. They're good looking, they're successful, but one of them is a very troubled person, and as the book goes on, you start to discover what has happened to him. And the reviews of this book have been extraordinary, because people have either said, like myself, that it's almost been akin to having a traumatic experience reading the book, because it is so visceral that by the time you come out of it, you actually just feel like a mess. And then other people said that they couldn't cope, that they had to stop reading the book because they thought it was too much, and they thought it was gratuitous, that they thought that they didn't need to be exposed to that level. So The New Yorker came out very strongly in favour. The Guardian was kind of saying, I can't cope with this book. But of all the books, when you look at your end of year lists, and it's already starting to happen, we're already seeing that, you know, well-known writers and names are picking, you know, for those features that always happen at the end of the year, it is the book that is emerging. So if you have time over Christmas and you're ready to commit to something, this is the thing. I mean, the books world is different as well. Everything's changing now. We're at a time of massive flux. I mean, musicians are having a really hard time of it because they're having to work day jobs and produce great music. You know, bands who are absolutely great, and I haven't mentioned like a few bands who've been, you know, on the scene, like, you know, De Laurentiis, Villagers, so many Irish bands and artists who, you know, do what they do, but then find other ways to make income as well. It's a tough world out there. But for authors, it's a very interesting time as well, because what's actually happening is you're getting books that are either enormous books, huge books, like Paul Murray's book, The Mark and the Void. It's a huge commitment to take on as a reader. You know, you're talking 700 pages. Or you're getting these really tiny books. So yeah. Gillian Flynn, the author of Gone Girl, she published it's essentially a short story or novella or something called The Grown-Ups, and it's $3.99, so you can go down to the shop and buy this little book and just put it in your handbag and read it. But it's one or the other, you know. People almost want, and theatre as well, like Gary Hines with Druid Shakespeare, she condensing, you know, four Shakespearean plays and then saying, right, we're going to start this at 11 in the morning and we're going to finish it about 11 at night. Yeah. And you're going to go to the theatre. Like, what are you going to do that day? I am going to this, you know? and it's about commitment, like, because we have trouble with commitment. Everybody at all the gigs, you know, that is watching, and I'm guilty of it myself, I see something really good and I go, oh, I'm going to take a picture of that, and then I'm going to put it on Instagram, and then I'm going to apply a filter. And somebody's actually played a whole song by the time I've done this, and I've missed it. Do you know what I mean? And we're all kind of doing that a little bit, and it's not great. So they talk as well about, you know, reading on screen as opposed to reading a printed material. When you read printed material, there's been investigation as to how we actually absorb that information, and that information goes into you at a slightly deeper level. They call it just deep reading, and you retain it slightly better. When you read on surfaces, on computers, on laptops, on your phone, you're taking in, but you're not retaining in quite the same way, and it's encouraging a sort of a flitty approach to your own life, which is actually quite important to be aware of. I think that's why increasingly I've started to get into very short books or very long books, because I want either massive commitment or something that I'm going to be done with in a couple of hours.
Okay. Have you finished City on Fire? Do you start it or finish it?
I started City on Fire.
I hope to get it read before the year ends.
This is the Garth Hallberg book, and it was optioned. He couldn't get it published for years, and it was optioned for who's making the film of it? It's Scott Rudin, or it's going to be huge. But I started reading it, and I actually had to put it down to get onto something for work, because I wasn't really reading it for work. But I will hopefully get back to it over Christmas, and it's beautifully written again. But again, it's somebody who was working an ordinary job, and I think I was reading an interview, his wife just like, this is just his obsession. But people just have these obsessions now. We have our actual work, and then we have our creative work, and a lot of people here are probably working a few different jobs and things they do for love and things they do for money. And I mean, I know myself, I've had three different jobs going probably for the last 10 years, and it's about bouncing between them. And sometimes I have like my freelance earnings and then my actual earnings, and when it comes to the end of the year, my accountant looks at me and he's like, why are you bothering? Because I really like it.
But that's the gig economy for you. I mean, that's like, you know, that's, again, it's an erosion of traditional work, you know, and suddenly the gig economy becomes the norm, and that's the way we all kind of work now. Mm-hmm. It's just portfolio careers. It's left, right and centre. Everyone's involved. Everyone has to get involved in it.
Mm. Yeah, it is. Yeah, I mean, it's just a very, very different way of thinking. And I think the world is changing. We're all changing. And we're living in a very interesting time for culture. It's not a real, like, in some ways, it's very easy to make an album now it's very easy to get some positive reviews in the local press, but it is incredibly difficult to make it your full-time career, and that's the case for almost every artist. The Taylor Swifts or the bigger authors, like the some of the crime authors that actually hire other people to write, you know, the sort of James Pattersons that have sort of ghostwriting factories and they trade on the name, and a book, a crime novel has to come out by the same author every year because they're in a very, it's like making a Mars bar, you know, it's a factory line production type of affair, and they're under extreme pressure. So they're at the very top of the market, hoovering up all the sales, and then there are people who are so far down the food chain and they can get a lot of attention from the critics, but no album sales. Like it's horrifying sometimes. It's actually quite difficult to get a look at album sales, but whenever you do, because you have to be a member of, you've probably seen this yourself.
Yes, record labels, yeah.
You have to be a member of Irma, and it's quite difficult to do, but when you get a look at it, it's horrifying, because bands can't make money.
Okay, you mentioned earlier on Paul Murray, and you mentioned kind of Kevin Barry. Was there any other Irish books which stood out?
Well, the Anne Enright book, The Green Road, which picked up the award for best, I think, Irish novel of the year at the Book Awards. I mean, that is a novel that's well worth reading. It's not an easy read. She's not an easy writer. I've struggled with her at times. She writes in a very compressed style, and this particular book is set from different perspectives, all of the children of a woman called Rosaline Madigan, and they all have different chapters of the book, essentially, or sections of the book. But you read Anne Enright because I think you'll read her and go, oh, geez, this is a bit tough. And then she'll write a sentence that strikes you as so true and real and could only be her, and it's witty and it's erudite, and she makes everything worthwhile.
Do you think there's too much hype around Irish literature in Ireland? Do you think we're too kind on our writers here? I'm not referencing now the Eileen Barsby assassination of the Paul Murray book, but like, you know, in general, do you think Irish writers get an easy ride from the Irish critics?
Do Irish writers get an easy ride from the Irish critics?
And that applies right across the board, Irish musicians, Irish filmmakers.
To be honest, I think they do. I think the musicians get an easy ride, actually.
What do you think that is? Is that
because
we meet
of the bloggers?
The
there's some great bloggers out there. There's some brilliant bloggers out there, but it's really interesting to see how the culture has changed, because when anyone can set up a blog, and that's a brilliant thing, and there's some brilliant people who've made their names through blogs, but the problem is they're suddenly subject to pressures that they are not sure how to handle. So if a band gives them a couple of free tickets to a gig and they're a 17-year-old blogger, and then they write an absolutely incredibly positive review that goes online and is available to be read instantly, as opposed to a newspaper that may be behind a paywall with somebody who's not subject to the same pressures. For example, if I give a band a bad review, I'm not going to lose my, you know, well, actually, in fairness, that has not with music, but I can think of an instance where that has happened in theatre. But you know, I'm not subject to the same pressures because I'm hired to do a job, and it's very hard when you're coming up through the ranks. And I mean, it's a terrible problem with, I mean, it's totally outside the arts, but with beauty bloggers, like, they're getting all these free products and they're like, oh, everything's brilliant, and people are probably getting scars and shit. But you know, it's
scars and shit, perfect.
but like, it's a different world. Everyone, and this is a good thing, everyone can be a critic and everyone has the capacity to do it, but everyone is also subject to different types of pressures and may not have either the independence of spirit or the understanding that they do actually need to look beyond that if they're to fulfil their remit as a critic. So I think that's a huge problem for musicians. I think it's a problem for the musicians themselves, like, because the musicians themselves suddenly think that they are shit hot all the time, and then they take their foot off the gas. They need to be hard on themselves as well and not get complacent. It's very difficult to break out of Ireland.
I think one of the problems is to do with writers and critics is to do with conflicts of interest, you know? Mm-hmm. That, like, I mean, it just strikes me that there's been a real breaking down of that kind of barrier between critics and who they're writing about. Being critics and who they're writing about. You okay?
Yeah, just pull the chain off the mic, sorry. Oh.
Yeah, for those listening on the podcast, Nadine's beautiful chain has got stuck on the microphone, and Andy, our great soundman, has asked her to remove the... oh, yeah, see what happened there.
You can continue there, Jim. I'll figure it out.
Well, got it. Okay, excellent. Like, I think one of the problems, basically, is that conflict of interest, that people don't realise, you know, that sometimes that if you are happen to be friends with someone, there is a financial interest there, that you shouldn't really be writing about the band or person in question.
Yeah, and it's actually a lesson that I think everyone at some point in their career has learned, and I would hesitate to just to say that it only pertains to bloggers. Journalists have learned it as well. We've all had brushes where, I mean, I've certainly turned around at, like, I can, you know, think of certain points where I've gone, actually, I can't cover this. I can't do this. This is the wrong thing. And you learn through experience. So I don't want to be down on one particular area of writing. But I think that as a culture, we're all moving towards a situation where, like, if you start work for any newspaper, they will usually give you a set of guidelines. You can actually even print off, like The Guardian have, like, you know, a set of sort of standards, if you like. And that's important. You need to know where the line is. You need to be told. I mean, the thing about GIFs as well, I mean, you all probably are online and on Twitter and that, and you can see when people are tweeting to say, look what I just got in the Post, you know, and they're standing next to it. I mean, that can be an issue. Like in the Business Post, we were given a directive last year that anything that was sent to us that was over €30, we just couldn't keep. Like we had no, like we had to either give it to charity or give it back or whatever. And it was a very good thing because you have to stay independent. What are you doing if you're sitting in work getting loads of swag thinking you're this is great? I mean, it was ridiculous, but that's happening everywhere.
Okay, let's move back to the arts then, because and let's move back to something you mentioned earlier on. You talked earlier on about Gary Hines and the Shakespeare Theatre. I mean, like, it's been a very interesting year in theatre, especially towards the latter half of the year, because then we had kind of like Fear coming out with the Abbey's programme for next year and getting rightfully walloped. I mean, like, from your point of view, you know, you wrote a really good column that Michael Collin got really snotty about on the Marion Finucane show, and she didn't pull him up on it at all.
Yeah, did you not think it was very interesting that Marion Finucane invited Michael Colgan, a man who was not in attendance at the Waking the Feminists rally, to explain Waking the Feminists to her? I couldn't.
Yeah,
but this really actually upset me, because I was listening to another station, and somebody, I got a flurry of texts saying, this man is giving out about you on radio. And I was like, what? So I listened back to Michael Colgan on the podcast, and Marion said to him, explain Waking the Feminist to me. And I mean, Leon Bell, who originated the movement, who pointed out there was a massive exclusion of female playwrights on the programme, and kickstarted it, got it going, gathered together more than 30 women to speak so powerfully from the stage of the Abbey Theatre, and Fiach MacNeil, to his credit, allowed that to happen, allowed the event to happen from the stage of the Abbey Theatre. No, but in fairness, no, I know there's a way of containing the problem by absorbing it and allowing people in, rather than having them standing outside the...
Well, my problem is more to do with the fact that, like, I mean, surely this programme was discussed internally, and, like, I mean, I know an awful lot of kind of, like, savvy, like, feminists who work in the Abbey, and this was aired, and why was nothing done before it was announced?
Yeah, and obviously the board gave approval to it, and... As Gary, I interviewed Gary Hines for the Sunday Business Post today, and she spoke about how any production takes a minimum of 2 years to get off the ground. You don't just turn around in October and say, "What will we do for, you know, this commemorative program?" It was a long time in a sort of gestated process, and it was allowed to go through. But I think that's to do with unconscious bias. I think that there was a really interesting survey about doctors. And the survey was talking about how doctors had a tendency to send people who weren't sort of white, male, middle class. They would they were unconsciously giving them better treatment, better drugs than they were with sort of African Americans. And when this was pointed out to them, they corrected their bias. The doctors were shocked in the particular hospital they were in, and they corrected their bias. I think what's happening is that this year is about learning that we need to correct our bias and check our privilege and understand. I have privileges as somebody who is, you know, born into a middle class family, got a good education, and was actually allowed to be able to scrape through as a freelance journalist for 7 years to get to a place where, you know, I could earn a living and become this. And a lot of people wouldn't have been able to do the scraping through for several years. So that's a privilege I have. And they need to have a look at what they have been privileged enough to experience. I mentioned in the column that when I was growing up, I didn't have that much access to works from the canon by female authors. And it was when I was reading people actually in more recent years, you know, memoirs by the likes of Kristen Hirsch, or, you know, when you read that amazing Viv Albertine book, you know, Girls, Music, Boys, that won the Rough Trade Book of the Year, and you see life through her eyes, like, I connected with that so strongly. And previously, I think sometimes I had thought that things that were good, I was being told they were good all the time, and I could appreciate that they were good, but I didn't connect as strongly. So I think it's very difficult for somebody like Fiacc MacNeil to understand maybe the exclusion of women, because it has always been his privilege to exist in a world that has accepted him and forwarded him and shown him his own perspective.
I understand what you mean by that, but at the same time, it's like, you know, it's 2015, Nadine. It's like, it's time to wake up to the fact that, you know, that we're talking about two genders and it should be equality. You said there earlier about the fact that it takes a theatre production 2 years to come together, right? This 2016 programme didn't kind of like come out, he didn't kind of like pull out a peak cap and pull it out there. It was in the works for quite some time. I find it very hard to believe that, like, he, at no stage along the process, that he didn't kind of check and kind of go, hang on a second.
But did you not see his tweet? Them's the breaks.
That's the one. That's the one he sent to
Bill McKeown. See you later.
Yeah. I mean, exactly. So it's like, it's a much deeper problem than just that kind of like that bias you're talking about.
Yeah, it's a huge problem. It's going to take a while to correct, but...
But it's endemic. It's endemic throughout Irish theatre as well, because
Michael Collins'
reaction to your column was definitely kind of proved, showed it to me. When I heard what he had to say, I was just going to myself, like, I mean, is this dude for real?
Yeah.
I mean, are we suddenly living in kind of like, I mean, some sort of like, I mean, mad Muslim world up in Parnell Square where all women are excluded?
Yeah, but I mean, there's... I thought that...
And I'm speaking here like as most unfeminist feminist around, you know?
But I thought his comments were pretty outrageous, but I thought the decision by the producers of the programme to have him on as the only representative talking about that was also outrageous. And I think there is also an issue with women who've reached a high peak in society. They need to look at themselves as well.
That's a good point.
It's very difficult when you're female, right, and you've gone through some difficulties to achieve prominence in your particular field. There's a real tendency to pull the ladder up after you, because you worry that you got to be the one in 10, so there's no other room, like, you know, there's no more space. So it'd be better if you just pulled up the rope ladder after you and sat there in your happy position and thought to yourself that it was because of your skills and your ability and your innate talent, because that's a lovely thing to think. But it's not correct. And I think it's as important for people in positions of power, such as Marion Fanucan, for example, and her producers, to really look at that. I mean, when I was working, the show I do now, Songs in the Key of Life, takes one guest every week on TXFM, and we, you know, chat about their lives, and they pick out songs to play. But previous to doing that, I was presenting and producing a broader show, and I did find it difficult sometimes to get female panellists on. And it was hard to see a lot of the time that women were so concerned that they wouldn't be good enough, because there was a confidence issue. And I think the people like Margaret E. Ward have done so much good work to just push women's confidence. And I've seen so many younger women, younger students coming through. Like, this isn't going to be fixed in 2015. But what we have done in 2015, I think, is identify the problem. And the first step in fixing the problem is identifying the problem.
Yeah.
I think we have to keep going. And I have found now, I've been in pubs and I have had people walk up to me and be quite, strangers, and be quite negative to me. Because they perceive what I've said in columns as equating to man-hating somehow. And I was having coffee the other day with a male novelist who shall remain nameless, and he went, "It's just awful now." And I was like, "Why?" And he was like, "Well, I mean, I can't get on this gravy train, you know, like, I can't ride the," you know, because he was starting to see that there was a surge in favour of pushing women forward, and he was starting to feel squeezed. And I was like, well, now you're actually seeing a little bit what it's been like for women over the years. Because when I started in my job as arts writer and critic, I was always interviewing male authors, because they would be sent on the book tours. They would come from America, and amazing people, you know, Richard Ford, Jonathan Franzen, you know, amazing talents coming over, Paul Auster, and you'd be so thrilled to see them. But after maybe 2 or 3 years of this interviewing, I realised that the only female that had been sent on book tour that I would have interviewed was Margaret Atwood. And I was like, what is happening? What's going on? But then it started to change, and women started getting shortlisted for major literary awards. They started winning major literary awards. And it became obvious to people as well that there were more female readers of fiction than male readers of fiction, because surveys were published and things started to happen. And a kind of equality has been put in place. It's been amazing to see how many women are featuring on shortlists, literary shortlists. So I think that we've seen some really positive things. I think in theatre, it's only just starting.
Okay, so let's go back to theatre then, because aside from kind of Waking the Feminists, what else stood out in Irish theatre this year, or international theatre? Because this one was point. I mean, every other kind of like sector, I would have kind of said today, music, books, film. I can go, yeah. I can add my list to that. I hate theatre. Theatre is the most boring form of art going. convince me otherwise, Aine.
Well, you know, it's funny that you say that, because Martin McDonagh was interviewed recently, and Martin McDonagh is like the amazing playwright behind you know, The Beauty Queen of Lenan, and he's also done the films in Bruges and what was the one, Seven Psychopaths?
Seven Psychopaths.
And he was actually talking about how much he hated Peter recently, and he was like, it's so boring, and so many of the plays are going to her shit. And the thing is, though, right, you have to be honest about this. A lot of theatre isn't great, right? A lot of new plays aren't going to be great because, hey, it's a huge deal to put a play on, and you go to it and you're expecting it to be perfect. It's not going to be perfect. It's not the money that's gone into a film or whatever. But I still think that we have incredible people coming up. You know, obviously from the younger side, like Grace Dias has done some really good work. Martin McDonagh himself has a new play, Hangman, on, which just transferred to the West End, and that's getting amazing reviews. I haven't seen it yet, but Our Few and Evil Days by Marco Rowe was fantastic in the Abbey earlier this year. And actually sold out. It made more money for the Abbey than almost any other play, I think. And who else? Enda Walsh is just a cracking writer, and he has done so much good work. I didn't get to see his opera, which was on earlier in the theatre festival, but I'm a huge fan of his, and he's just done, you know, from Mr. Man, the work he's done with Cillian Murphy. I think we have still have some really good people. It's obvious that we're losing people to film and to TV, and that's a problem in some ways, but also an opportunity in other ways. And, you know, I know, could I convince you to go to the theatre? If you don't like the theatre, like,
I used to live with a theatre critic in 18, and he's going to remain nameless, Jocelyn Clark. I used to live with Clarkie, and he was a theatre critic for the Sunday Tribune, back in the day. And he would always try and drag one of us, be it me or my girlfriend at the time, or like a housemate, along to see the play, you know. And you give up once in a while, and you go, okay. Admittedly, I saw some amazing stuff. I saw some incredible stuff. So you talked earlier on about that, like that 12-hour play that Gary Hines put on. I saw Seven Streams of the River Otto. That was like 12 hours in London. It's amazing. Like there's some great stuff, but Jesus Christ, if you see one episode of, like, if you see one Sebastian Barry play where the stage, the curtains go away, and there on the stage is an old woman dying on the bed, 4 hours later she's still fucking dying.
No, it's like, when you really want her to die, when you're kind of watching it and being pleased.
It comes back to what we said earlier on, though. It's just that there's not enough time. I mean, we live in an attention economy. We live in, like I said, an economy where basically my attention, my time is the most important thing I have. Yeah. I'm not going to see, there's nothing worse than seeing a bad play. There really isn't, because you can't escape.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's true. Well, you can kind of.
I can tell some stories here, but they're very libelous about certain well-known theatre practitioners and how they get out of seeing bad plays and how rude they are in the theatre, but won't go there.
Yeah, well, I mean, This Is Pop Baby have done some good work as well. And, you know, you were saying about giving bad reviews. Like, it's funny, I hate actually giving bad reviews of theatre. I do it, but sometimes when you know how much work has gone into something and then you didn't enjoy it at the end of the day and you have to sort of say that. Like, you mentioned Eileen Battersby review of Paul Murray's book, The Mark and the Void, and I think there's a very interesting trend happening this year where newspapers have to take some responsibility for what they are actually doing, like, behind the scenes. I'm not saying that newspaper editors are asking their critics to come up with particularly charged reviews, but I would say that anyone who is knowledgeable about the newspaper scene can point to particular critics in particular newspapers and understand that that person is the person, the go-to person for the vicious review.
Or also,
so if you think of any publication, and if I say Sunday Times, I know you'll know.
Oh, yeah. I mean, and surely as well, like, I mean, that comes down to the kind of like the power of the commissioning editor. Are there times when you've given the book to certain critics to review, knowing that, like, I mean, the review may not be favourable, but it'll be quite colourful and it'll help to kind of spread the word
about it? See, that's the thing, right? That's the thing.
Yes or no answer?
Yeah, absolutely.
Perfect.
but there was a review that we published in the Sunday Business Post, and I don't think you'd mind me saying it. It was written by Kevin Power, and it was a review of the Colin McCann novel, not the new one, the one previous to that. And that review went through three different edits, because the first review, the first version, was, I mean, it was...
Blood on the page.
It was. And the thing was, it wasn't that we did publish what amounted to a very, very, very negative review. And, 6 months later, I was still having people come up to me going, wow, that was an incredibly negative review. But we took out anything that we considered to be overly personalised. Not that I think that critic would have ever done it on purpose. But if there is a difference between saying, this is a bad book, and saying, not only is this a bad book, this writer can't write and will never write and will never produce anything of worth and basically should never leave their house again. And I'm embarrassed for them, right? And when you have that like situation where you feel that line has potentially been crossed, then as a commissioning editor or an editor, which I'm getting the copy in as well as writing myself, like you do look at it and you go, okay, well let's have a few passes at this and see where that line is, because there is actually a difference. And we all know it. Anyone that writes knows it. Because what happens is you get into a blind fury, you know? You're talking about the stuff that you don't like and you get really worked up and you go, and furthermore, you know, they've also got a shit name. And it should be the same. What you say to your friend on the phone when they go, what was the Morrissey book like? And you go, oh, really bad. But you shouldn't go, it should mimic, it should reflect what you'd say to your friend. It shouldn't be so heightened a version for colour that you wind up making it into a cartoon.
Yeah.
It's very good reading sometimes, those cartoons. But would say, like personally, I would say that The Mark and the Void, for my money, I thoroughly enjoyed reading it. And I found the Eileen Battersby review to be kind of hard to understand, because her central premise, I didn't agree with, that the storyline essentially was not interesting. Because I think any subject matter can be interesting. I think a small kitchen drama can be interesting. Or a huge world war can be interesting. So I couldn't see the logical basis.
Well, the review encouraged me to download the book and read it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, maybe that's a good thing. Maybe polarizing reviews. I mean, I did read of one publication who would encourage their reviewers to give album reviews either 5 stars or 1 star, because nobody reads the 3 star. You kind of skip past it. If you see a 1 star, you're like, ooh, what the hell happened here? Or if you see the 5 star, you're like, maybe I should buy it. So that's a factor. But I think there's a responsibility and conversations need to be had by commissioning editors. I don't think there's anything wrong with having a reviewer Rottweiler hanging around the building. But just make sure that you have that control.
Make sure there's a kind of like a mask on now and again.
Well, I thought it was laudable that the Irish Times followed up that review with a long feature about reviewing and, you know, the nature of reviewing and what people... And I thought it was... in my estimation, and just my opinion, but I thought it was a kind of apology for that review.
Okay, I'm not going to speak. I got attacked yesterday by owner Brendan Sinn Féin as a representative of the Irish Times, so I'm not going to even pretend to be a representative of the Irish Times here. One last question for you. What are you looking forward to in the arts and culture in 2016?
Oh, I can't wait to see Room. I actually missed the press screening because it was coming down here, and I saw some people tweeting and they said it was amazing. It's Emma Donoghue's novel, which has been adapted by Lenny Abramson, and it's just getting absolutely stellar reviews. Obviously Star Wars, I mean, like that's not 2016, but it hasn't happened yet. So that's also, like, I'm really looking forward to that. And, you know, we had such a good year in fiction that... I think 2016 is going to be terrible for fiction. I think there's going to be no really good books. So, like, no, but it's true. You have really bumper years. Like you had people like Belinda McCone bringing out, you know, a novel. She's not going to produce a novel for 3 years. Sinead Leeson did The Long Gaze Back. Great anthologies this year. Loads of short story collections. You know, as I was mentioning there, you had people like Kevin Barry coming out. And like Enda O'Brien published her first book in 10 or 12 years, I think. The Little Red Chairs. Like, obviously, she's not going to be out with something else in 2016. I mean, I do look forward to seeing the schedules, but the details at the moment are pretty sketchy. But I think that everyone has been pretty sure, like with the likes of Sarah Baum and other young writers coming to the fore, that next year is going to be crap. Like,
fucking great. We're not going to have you back in December. So anyway, thank you very much, Nadine O'Regan. That was a great review. Thank you very much, Nadine. Thanks a million to Nadine for joining us by the fire in Foxy John's for that spirited review of the art tier. This podcast was recorded by Andy Wilson for Other Voices, produced by Tanya White, and made with the help of Molly King and all the Other Voices. If you've enjoyed this podcast, please rate us and spread the word. Tell your friends about us, recommend us on your favourite social media network, leave a review or a rating on the iTunes store, and don't forget to subscribe. Check out thisisbanter.com for news of what we're up to at Banter. We'll be back next week with another podcast. Until then, goodbye and take care.